You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Faulkner County native Red Hall was a serial killer who confessed to murdering at least 24 people. Most of his victims were motorists who picked him up as he hitchhiked across the United States. In the closing months of World War II, he beat his wife to death and went on a killing spree across the state. His signature smile lured his victims to their doom, and even after his capture, he maintained a friendly manner, being described by one lawman as a pleasant conversationalist. Author Janie Nesbitt Jones chronicles his life for the first time and explores reasons why he became Arkansas's hitchhike killer. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Arkansas Hitchhike Killer, James Wayburn Red Hall, with my special guest, journalist and author, Janie Nesbitt Jones. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview. Janie Nesbitt Jones.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for this joining me for this incredible tale. Let's talk about, this is set in Faulkner County, Arkansas. Maybe you can tell us just a little bit about where this is, and this is ironically called Happy Valley. So tell us where Enola and Faulkner County, Arkansas, and just set the stage for, we're talking about the Hall family and the Ingram families. Tell us a little bit about their settling in Happy Valley.
Okay. Faulkner County is just north of Pulaski County, where the state capital, Little Rock, is. And Enola is a part of Faulkner County. It's a little town. And there were several communities around Enola back in the old days, back in the 1800s, one of which was Happy Valley. It was just a small community, like a lot of others, and people were mostly in agricultural-type situations. The business was usually centered around agriculture. And I say something about Enola and that area in particular. It seems to have an unusual number of people who live for a long time, even past 100.
Right.
But anyway, Happy Valley, yes, it was one of those small communities sort of connected. Enola was a social hub. That's where the post office was. And the Hall and Ingram families moved into that area in the 1800s and became neighbors. And then they became more than neighbors when Samuel Jerome Hall married Eva Lorraine Ingram. They had 10 children, one of whom was Red. His name was James Wayburn, but everybody called him Red because he had beautiful red hair, wavy red hair. And his father was a preacher and farmer who was a strict disciplinarian, especially with Red. I don't know if it was because Red was just more playful, more of an explorer. I probably got into trouble more, but his father was unusually strict with him. He did physically and verbally and psychologically abuse Red, and this was told to me by Red's cousin, Connie. Her name was Carnella Hall, and everybody called her Connie. She married a Mr. Weir, Connie Weir. So she told me a lot about the childhood. She said that her father was very, very nice, but Red's father was not. She called him El Diablo, preacher with horns, or devil.
Right.
And she saw one time how physically abusive Samuel was with Red. He just beat him terribly. And sometimes it seemed to be over nothing. So Red started wandering away from home. He would wander around the county, and his father would go drag him back home, and that made his father even madder at him. And then as he grew older, he started wandering even farther away around the state. Now, when he was about 12 years old, he suffered a head injury. Most say it was a farming accident, but some people wondered if his father had hit him a little too hard and once too often. But it was a serious injury because Red, he was unconscious. He was knocked unconscious and was out for quite a while. And people said he was just never really the same after that. But anyway, as he was growing up, when he became a teenager, he started wandering on to other states. Mm-hmm. And he would be gone for weeks at a time. Then one day in 1938, he met his wife-to-be. Her name was Walsy McKee, and they met at church. And Walsy was a shy, naive young girl. She never went to dances or anything like that, so she was had led a very sheltered life. But she was attracted to Red because he had been to all these other places, and she was just got absorbed in the stories that he would tell her about these places he had been.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked her to marry him. They had seen each other for quite a while, and then they decided to get married. Well, her mother, Amanda McKee, moved in with them, and that kind of irked Red. But the problem still mainly was Red's wandering ways. During the time he was married to Walsy, he would still go off and be gone for a long time. She and her mother would be left to do the farm chores, and she would sometimes have to ask her in-laws for help in bringing in the crops and things like that. In 1941, around Christmas time, Red happened to be home. He knew that their baby, their first baby, was due. So they called the doctor, and unfortunately, the baby was a stillbirth. He died at birth. And while the doctor was tending to Walsy, Red had some sort of fit. He had been sitting on a couch, and then when the doctor told him that things were not going well and that they would be losing the baby, Red fell off the couch, and the doctor said when he got back up, his eyes were twitching. And then he just sat there quietly. So anyway, they did lose that first child. And then she was okay. Walsy was okay. And things went back to normal, which meant that, yeah, Red was wandering away again. And then I will say they did have a second child who lived. But at one point, they finally decided that it just wasn't working out, although it was Red who actually wanted the divorce. So they did. Red and Walsy divorced. And he moved on. but he had been still in one place just long enough to be drafted, because at that time, World War II, this was in, like I said, late 1930s, and by this time it was the early 40s. And the services, they needed more men to fight the war. So he was drafted by the Navy. But after 6 weeks, they let him go. Yes, they discharged him, and they said the reason was indifference. He didn't know what that meant. Apparently they didn't explain it, but he was just happy about it. So he was free to go his own way. And he met a young lady named Fayrene Clemens, and he fell in love with her, and she was very attracted to him. So they got married. Let's see, they were married in March 1944,
mm-hmm.
and she was not anything like Walsie. She was headstrong, independent, curious, and when he wanted to go somewhere, she wanted to go with him. So on one trip, they went up to Oregon together, and that I'll bring that back up a little later.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a rocky marriage, really, from the start. He was rough, and he would hit her. And her family, which consisted of her parents, and she had a sister, Imogene, they would see her with bruises all the time when they would come, when she would go back home to their farm. And so they knew that he was roughing her up. She tried leaving him once. In fact, she did leave him once. And she stayed with a friend for a little while. But then she decided to give it one more chance. So she went back to Red. They were living in a little apartment behind a grocery store, and she wanted to go out. She enjoyed, she wasn't a social butterfly, but she just enjoyed a good time. So one night, she wanted to go to this place. It was called the Rainbow Garden. The Rainbow Garden was a ballroom that sat atop what they call the largest gas station in the world. It was called the 555 building because there was the big letters, or big figures, numbers, numerals, I guess I should say, 555. That was the telephone number for that gas station. The gas station was located on the ground floor, of course, and then they had one floor that was given over to cars where people could park their cars or rent cars and things like that. And then, like I said, the top floor was the ballroom. And she just loved that place. Fayrene loved that place. So she decided one Thursday night in September to ask her friend Katie Bryant to go with her and Red that night because it was ladies' night at the Rainbow Garden. So Katie said, sure, and they picked her up, and they went and danced and had a good time. At midnight, though, Red wanted to leave, and Katie really needed to because she worked. So Fayrene wanted to go down in the elevator because she was wearing new shoes, and they were hurting her feet. But Red insisted on going down the stairs, and they started sniping at each other, and he got rough. So they went out to the car. They finally got down, and she told Red, she said, I won't live with you. And he slapped her. Well, she went ahead and got in the car, and Katie got on the outside. She sat up front, and Red got in, and they took Katie home. They dropped her off. And that was the last time anybody saw Fayrene alive.
Now, let's go backwards just a little bit, because we've missed a couple things for our audience in terms of her friend Muriel Stevenson. And this is just previous to this, a few days before. Muriel Stevenson goes to Hall's apartment, and Red isn't there. So she talks with Fayrene, and Fayrene shows her something. what is that that she shows her, and what's so unusual about what she did show her?
Okay, yes. She had a new dress, and it was unusual. It was a two-piece. It was red, but the unusual thing about it was how the closures worked. They weren't just regular buttons. They were these little closures. It's sort of hard to describe, but they looked like, one person described them as looking like tiny little swords or nails, mm-hmm. or something like that, that you had to slip through something else. So they were unique. They'd never seen anything like that. And Muriel was also Faye's sister-in-law. And they would go shopping together. And besides the dress, she tried on those shoes that I was talking about. Because on one shopping trip with Muriel, she had bought those shoes, and she was trying to break them in. So anyway, Muriel and Faye had a pretty good visit that Sunday. But that was the introduction to the outfit. One thing that helped identify her remains later.
Okay, let's go back to the evening in question. When they drop off Katie, she sees this altercation, this heated argument between them, and words have said. What are some of the things that were said that Katie heard in the exchange between them?
One thing Red was always mad about was he thought that Faye was too extravagant. He drove a cab. He was a cab driver, and he made pretty good money, but he accused Faye of being a spendthrift. That was one thing. And then she had, there were words spoken about going, that was really more Red, though, later on, I was going to say, about going to the coast. But they had an argument. So Katie knew about all this when they dropped her off. And then, if you want me to go on, that night.
We talk about Muriel. You talk about Muriel the next morning. So tell us what Muriel does and what happens with the rest of Faye's family afterwards in the following days.
Okay. Muriel calls Red. Let's see, that was Muriel had seen her on Sunday. Thursday was the last time, was when Katie Bryant saw her Faye for the last time. And then Muriel calls Red that Friday, I believe it was. And Red says she's not there, and he doesn't know where she is. So that alerted Muriel, and also there were three cousins of Faye's who were coming up from Pine Bluff, Arkansas, to visit Faye. But again, Red said that she was gone, and that's how her family, the Clemens family, found out that she was missing, because they knew that she would never take off like that and not contact her family. They were a close family, and she talked to them often. So they knew something was wrong. So her mother and Imogene, her sister, went to the Little Rock Police Department to talk to the chief of detectives there, O.N. Martin. And they told him what had happened, and she was married. They started talking about Red, and Martin said, "Well, have you talked to him?" And they said, "Well, we've tried, but he's never around." So after they left, the chief there sent two detectives. One was Herbert Peterson, and the other one, Judd. His name was Detective Judd. So Peterson and Hud went to the taxi stand where Red worked, And so that got things moving a little bit, because you may be able to run from family members, but you can't run from the cops. They're going to keep on till they find you. So he just told them that Feyrene had left and gone to the coast. But see, the thing was, her clothes were still at home in their little apartment. Her clothes were still there. So that indicated she hadn't packed. If she had left, she hadn't packed. So anyway, the cops talked to Red, and he doesn't really give a satisfactory answer except for saying that she left for the coast. And they say, you mean, and they say, how did that happen? What happened that night? And he said, well, we got home, and they were arguing. We were arguing, and then I just went on to bed. Let's see. He gets up, he says, this is what he tells the cops. He gets up, and he realizes Faye is not there. He goes through a couple of the rooms. It's a small apartment, and she's just not there. But he goes back to bed, and they say, your wife disappears, and you go back to bed? But there you begin to see how Red had strange ways of thinking. He was a combination. He was a complex, complicated person. And I do theorize in the book, as did his defense attorney, that accident that occurred when he was 12 years old affected him somehow, that it caused brain damage. And that is entirely possible, I think. He seemed to have no impulse control, which might lead to you to think about the frontal lobe damage when he was knocked on the head. So he had this explosive temper. He had that, and yet on the other side, he was friendly and talkative. One place he moved to after Feyrene, he was still on Little Rock, but he moved into a room with a landlady, Fanny Rose. She was so pleased with him as a tenant that she started leaving the door unlocked. I mean, she was so comfortable with him. There was nothing to indicate that he was a violent serial killer, and by that time he had killed a lot of people. And while the investigation into Faye's disappearance is going on, the Arkansas State Police are being bombarded with these crimes, murders, and they quickly come to the idea that it is a hitchhiker. The killings do indicate a hitchhiker. The first one occurs in January, following Faye's disappearance in September. And that was Mr. Hamilton, Carl Hamilton. He was a bootlegger and a barber in Camden, Arkansas. So state police, they learn about that, and Hamilton was killed by a 45 pistol. And the ballistics expert with the state police was Alan Templeton. He was great at his job. The captain was J. Earl Scroggin. And their chief detectives on the case were Homer Sims and Oliphant, Rhett Oliphant. So first there's the murder in Camden, and they find out, they realize that he probably didn't get very much. This is the interesting thing about Red's murders. He would steal, but he never got anything. Hardly. Sometimes he would get, like, for instance, a second victim, which came at the 1st of February, was Mr. Adams, E.C. Adams. He was from Kansas, and he was coming to Arkansas. He was going to go down to Camden, where they had an ordnance plant, and get a job there. So he picked up Red in Little Rock. And not too long after that, his body is found. He's shot in the head. Now, this time, he was shot with a 38. And I might add that the reason the state police were called in on that first murder, the one with Mr. Hamilton, was because the 45 sort of gave them an idea, that the people there in Camden, the officers, that maybe it might have been a soldier, because that was the firearm used by soldiers. So that first murder, see, he used a 45. Now, in the second murder of Mr. Adams, he used a 38. So, and then, let's see, the next one, we're still going on, and Doyle Mulhern. I'm not sure I've pronounced that correctly. It's Mulhern.
Mulhern.
But I think
Mulhern.
Mulhern. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's spelled like Mulhern, but I'm thinking because the way we talk here in Arkansas sometimes, it may be Mulhern. And he was a driver for a meatpacking company. He was going to Stuttgart. He left Little Rock, and at some point he picked up Red. We know this because Mulhern's route, it went from Little Rock to Stuttgart. And on the way there, he would always pass another delivery truck going in the opposite direction, but he always recognized the driver, and they would wave at each other.
Right.
Also, that other driver had a father who lived along the route, so that sometimes he would give his father a ride. And that his father was standing out there by the roadside, and he saw Red in this truck with Doyle Mulhern, and they said the same thing, both the driver, the truck driver who knew Doyle Mulhern, both he and his father described the same person, and they both said he had wavy red hair, and that was the first clue they had, the state police. So you have these two investigations going on, the state police and the Little Rock Police Department. And somewhere along the line, well, yes, I'm losing track here, but I'm back on course. So he does kill Mr. Mulhern, and he kills him with that 38. Okay, so his next victim is
Janie, excuse me for a second. We're going to stop for a second to hear from our lease commercial break. Pardon me with that. You also write at that time, right after the murder of Mulhern, and with these people seeing this young man with red hair, these witnesses clearly saying this man with red, wavy hair, this is the first time he's called the hitchhike killer officially, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. Now, let's go back to just, you say there's two investigations, so that's good that we identify. That's the Arkansas State Police and then the Little Rock Police Department. So... unlike many, many stories where police in different jurisdictions almost act like they're competitive and don't share information, And even if that's not the motivation, they don't share information, and the perpetrator goes on to kill longer than they maybe could have possibly if the jurisdictions cooperated. Now, with Little Rock Police Department and Arkansas State Police, when does it that they get together and start talking and seeing similarities in some
point.
Of these killings?
Yes, that's a good point, because I was so impressed with that. He has one more victim. He kills Mr. Newcomb. But along about the same time, now this is March 1945, so the war is coming to an end.
Right.
All this news about the hitchhikers and stuff like that, it doesn't get a lot of press. But Red ends up in a brawl. It's a back alley brawl behind a cafe or a bar. And he beats a guy so bad that the guy is in the hospital for weeks. I mean, he's on the critical list. But they do arrest. Now, this is the Little Rock Police, of course, who arrest Red. But he gets off with just a fine and court costs. It's almost unbelievable. He gave that guy such a beating, but I think he pleaded self-defense, and he would always say his father was a preacher, and, you know, he was a religious man and all things like that. So this is where they begin to cross over. Let's see. After Newcomb, the state police, Captain Scroggin, gets a tip over the phone. It's a woman who tells him that a relative of hers works at the same taxi station as Red Hall. Her relative is an ex-convict. He just knows that Red is the killer because I use some fake names.
Right.
If I interviewed somebody and they didn't want to give their name, I would use another name. In this case, all the news reports use different names for this other taxi driver. They wanted to protect him. He was not involved in the killing, but he noticed he carried a .45 in his taxi. And Red wants to borrow his taxi. And that's what he does when he goes down to kill Mr. Hamilton. That's why he uses a .45. But he puts that .45 back where it was in the car and returns it to, I'll call him Mr. Blaine, the other taxi driver. And Blaine is suspicious. He's very suspicious because of one thing that Red had said he was going out on the road to make some money. And so Blaine, he realizes that the gun has been fired. And he's telling his relative about this, but he doesn't want to get involved because he's afraid the authorities will suspect him because of his record.
Mm-hmm.
But his relative calls this in to Captain Scroggin. And so they go pick up Blaine. But meanwhile, Scroggin calls Chief Martin with the Little Rock Police Department.
Right.
And that's when they realize, Captain Scroggin had learned the name. Blaine had told him that it was Red Hall, James Red Hall.
Yeah.
So the state police know his name now. They get in touch with the Little Rock Police Department, and they know his name because, the most recent thing was that brawl in the alley. But then they tell, Martin tells Scroggin that Hall is suspected in the disappearance of Faye. That's when they join forces. And they do still have two investigations going. Homer Sims and Rhett Oliphant, I mean, they've made a lot of trips. They started in Kansas when they were investigating the D.C. Adamses. That was the second murder in 1945. And so anyway, they've done a lot of work on that. So anyway, when they realized, when the two different lawmen decide that this is linked, of course, by this one guy, Red Hall. So Peterson and Judd, Harold Peterson and Herbert, Harold Judd and Herbert Peterson, the detectives with the Little Rock Police Department, they go pick Red up at the taxi station. Yeah. And when they pick him up, oh, he's just so friendly, and he thinks it's about his wife again. They've already asked him once about his wife, and he figures it's just that. He has no idea. He has no idea. So they take him in, and they hold him there, and they just kind of let him stew for a while, lock him up. They search him, of course, and they find a postage or a receipt. Postage receipt. And it was a package. They traced it, and it was a package that he had sent to a female friend, not necessarily girlfriend. We don't really know about that. Corinne Franklin. So they go talk to her, and she said, yes, he did send her something. And it, once again, you'll see here what he would take from his victims, and it's just crazy. He had stolen from Mr. Adams, he had stolen things like razor blades, cigarettes, let's see. He was always going after his cigarettes, clocks and watches. And people on the street, and I've had somebody already comment on this, he would sell the clocks and things to people on the street. It's so hard to believe, but he did. People he'd be carrying this clock, and they'd say, yeah, I'd like to buy that for a couple of dollars. And that's all he would ever get. It's just crazy. But
you
anyway,
talk about this.
You
talk about this interrogation as well. And then, as you mentioned, they talk to other people. They find a watch with initials JDN engraved. So it's not very bright that he keeps all of this stuff. But also in this interrogation, which very, very interesting, is a beat reporter for one of the newspapers, I believe the Gazette. Tell us about Joe Wergis, if that's his pronunciation of his name, and his, again, for people reading this, will be his unusual role within this interrogation.
Yes, I love Joe Wergis. It's Wergis, and I love him. If there were a novel, I mean, he'd be a great character, but this was true. Mm-hmm. He was. He became a copy boy for the Democrat Gazette. That was one of the two main state newspapers back then. We had the Arkansas Gazette and the Arkansas Democrat, and he was with the Gazette from the age of about 15, I believe it was. He started way back, like 1913 or something like that. And he becomes the police beat reporter. And he becomes such a good friend with all these different agencies, the sheriff's office, the police, the city police, the state police. They all love him. And he has a dry sense of humor that is just precious. he will help the police, especially the Little Rock police. He would even type up their reports, and they trusted him. They really counted him as one of their own. He says funny things, and I wish I could have known him. He's in on, he's there when they get the confession, stays with this. Would you like for me to tell you a little about the interrogation?
Yeah, well, tell us about the interrogation, but also some of the staging that they did. And again, this is way ahead of their time. I saw this on Criminal Minds and read it in Mindhunter, but there's some staging done, and there's some real strategizing done before they talk to them. Tell us about the staging, but also tell us how they decided to approach him psychologically to elicit this confession.
Well, they staged it by putting these items on a table that they were going to bring him into the room, and there's a table in there, and they put one of the clocks from Mr. Adams and a gun, two guns actually, and they put this on Captain Scroggins' desk or table, and they cover it with newspapers, and they bring him in, and they do have sort of an idea about his personality, I guess you could say. He's very friendly, and he's not easily rattled. He's not. But for the interrogation, they bring in both, again, the Little Rock Police and the State Police. So in there you have Captain Scroggins, Judd Peterson, they're with the Little Rock, and with the State Police, with Scroggins, there's Sims and Oliphant, and Joe Lurgis.
Yeah.
And they have to introduce him to Joe, because he doesn't know, of course, who that is. But then, now, Herbert Peterson, he was the one who actually led the interrogation. The others would ask questions from time to time, like Sims and Oliphant. They would say something about the hitchhike killings. Now, Red didn't know, see. He didn't know that they were suspecting him of those. That's the first inkling he had about that.
Right.
So he pleads dumb. He just stays dumb on that. He doesn't know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Peterson. Now, Peterson stays on his feet, and he paces back and forth. He gets down in Red's face. He's the toughie. You hear about good cop, bad cop? Well, he's the bad cop. So they grill him for a long time, and little by little, Scroggins will move the papers on the desk. I think the first thing that Red sees is one of the clocks. He thinks that's strange, you know, that's really weird, and it does confuse him a little bit there. But they go on with the interrogation. He's still denying everything. And then Scroggins pulls a few more papers aside, and there's a gun. It's one of the guns. It's a gun. And he still doesn't say anything. But then, finally, Peterson gets to him by talking about his son, the little baby.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Red, he always says the thing that he would say if he loved somebody, he would say, "I'm crazy about her," like Walsy.
Yeah.
"I was just crazy about her," and his little baby boy, "I'm just crazy about him." And he said, well, he always saw to it that he sent $10 a month to help Walsy with the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And Peterson says, is that a good dad or something like that? You know, he says, that's not all a father does. And he does get rattled, and then finally Scroggins pulls back the last paper, and there is the .38 pistol. There's the murder weapon. And at that point, he just throws up his hands, leans back in the chair, and says, "I'll tell you about it. I'll tell you about all of them." I said, "I killed them all."
Yeah.
So, and then from there, they, yeah. they learn
let's
a
use
lot.
This as, yes, let's use this as, use this as an opportunity to stop to hear from our sponsor, which is Magic Spoon. We're all trying to eat better, but healthy breakfast doesn't have to be boring. Magic Spoon has the amazing flavors you love, but without all the bad stuff. 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. Only 140 calories a serving. It's keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, low-carb, and GMO-free. There are 4 flavors in the variety pack, cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter, and the flavors are delicious. Magic Spoon tastes like the classic breakfast cereals I grew up on, like Fruit Loops and Frosted Flakes, but Magic Spoon is super nutritious. Go to magicspoon.com/truemurder to grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use our promo code TRUEMURDER at checkout to save $5 off your order. And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/truemurder and use the code TRUEMURDER to save $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode. Now, Janie, when we last left off, we were talking about the confession, and the detectives were masterful in appealing to this person, saying, do you want your son to remember you as a coward?
Yes.
You be a man and take the consequences. And
yes.
So the staging and the confrontation psychologically this way, and finally said, as you said, I'll tell you all about it. I killed them all. Now,
mm-hmm. You
say that his statements cleared up the 4 hitchhike murders and his wife's disappearance, and just as they feared, Faye Reen was dead, according to Red Hall. Tell us about what he does say about the 4 hitchhike murders and all the murders that he confesses to in this confession.
Well, he eventually does take them to all the crime scenes.
Right.
But with Faye, he said, yes, he killed her that previous September. But at one point, he says, because she knew too much. He would say 2 different things as motive for killing Faye Reen. First, that she spent all his money, and the other, and that she was too bullheaded. He'd never known a woman that bullheaded. And then, two, he was afraid. Earlier, you know, I mentioned Oregon, and I said I would come back to that.
Mm-hmm.
While he was married to Faye Reen, she did accompany him on a trip up to Oregon. And things were different after that. And her family suspected that she knew something. The cops suspected that she knew something that Red had done in Oregon. And that's what Red, mm-hmm. that was the other motive, he said, was she knew too much.
Right.
So she either knew too much about a murder or something in Oregon, or what did she? He never really spells that out. He just says that she knew too much.
Mm-hmm. So
and then,
he talks about, they ask him about Carl Hamilton. What does he tell them in terms of the motive for this? They have an idea that this motive all along was robbery, but they ask him what his motivation was, and why does he tell them he killed Carl Hamilton?
Well, yeah, he said he went down there. He was going to, he went down there really to rob Hamilton, but he tells them that Hamilton pulls a gun on him, and Red, then he pulls that .45, and he shoots Hamilton. There wasn't really anything. It's funny. There some things that I could never find the figure out. and I'll get back to this later, but a ring that comes up later. But anyway, can you point me in the right direction here as far as what you were asking?
Well, we're talking about Carl Hamilton and just what he said in terms of motive. And he had said that he originally went to rob him, but then there was a confrontation. So then he has other...
Yeah.
Of course, they ask him about Mulheron, and so he says he pulled the gun and forced him to stop and took him to a secluded spot and shot him in the head, and he got $100 from that. You also go on talk later about psychopathic personality, but what's interesting is this interrogation, his demeanor at this interrogation, and once he does start confessing, the manner in which he does do that, you comment as well. Tell us how he talks about these crimes.
He's so nonchalant about it. Just like he talks about murder, and I think it's Owen Martin who later says something like, he says he talks about murder like it's an everyday thing, an everyday occurrence.
Sure.
It doesn't mean anything to him. He's just removed from it. He shows no emotion. The first time he shows any emotion is when his father comes to see him. They meet on the sidewalk outside the jail, and he breaks down. That's the first time. It's when he sees his father for the first time after his arrest, and he does break down. But, he tells them about all the different ones. He explains everything. He tells them that... let's see, with Mr. Adams, he had walked him several feet or yards away from the car into the edge of the woods that day, shot him in the back of the head, and he would even take off the victim's shoes looking for money. I mean, he figured everybody had money stuck somewhere, stowed away. And then he talked about, Mulheron was the second one, and he said, he's just nonchalant about it all. Now, Doyle Mulheron, and this jived with what the witnesses saw, Mulheron was fighting for control of the truck. So he killed him pretty soon after those witnesses saw them together in the truck. And he takes a truck, and then he took the truck on through Stuttgart and just left it there, and he started hitchhiking back to Little Rock. And at some point, a guy picks him up, another good, kind motorist picks him up, and the motorist gets, he gets spooked. He was just nervous about the way Hall was acting.
Mm-hmm.
And so he pretended to have a headache and said he couldn't, he'd have to stop. But that just shows you. I mean, he just kills somebody. Then he gets picked up by somebody. He hitchhikes again, gets picked up. He's always so easily picked up. I mean, he was always smiling and friendly. I mean, once the person stopped, they were just won over because he was charming, I guess you could say, in a crude sort of way. He wasn't well-educated or anything like that, but he could just win people over. He had some sort of charisma. And he almost killed somebody else right after he killed Mulheron.
Mm-hmm.
And then he tells them about Mr. Newcomb. Mr. Newcomb, that happened in Faulkner County. So my husband and I went down about where, of course, things are so different now. That was back in 45. It was about the area or the spot where he pulled over. Newcomb pulls over, and he fights. He's really the only one that, for some reason, had a chance to fight back.
Right.
And right at that time, and this shows you how much nerve Red Hall had, while he's fighting with Newcomb, a couple drive up coming toward Conway, and they stop momentarily. Now, the driver, which is the husband, he sort of wants to stop because he thinks a couple of people are in trouble or something. But his wife urges him to go on because she thinks it's just a couple of drunks fighting. Well, so they go on, and it was just right after that that he kills Newcomb. He got Newcomb back in the – he was trying to get him back in the backseat, the floorboard, and he ends up shooting him in the face. I mean, Newcomb really put up a fight, but lost. And then another thing that baffles the detectives is the way Hall thought about, I don't know, trying to get away with things. When, after he killed Newcomb, he decides he wants to put the body in some water somewhere. Well, he's passing through Conway, and the river is just a few miles. At that time, it was a few miles from the city of Conway. The city's grown a lot since then, but he didn't. He did not turn and go to the Arkansas River and put Newcomb in there. No, he just kept driving north, trying to and looking, he said, for a place, a body of water. But, I mean, there are so many opportunities. The Little Red River, different things, different places like that, where he could have disposed of the body easily and without anybody seeing him. But, no, he doesn't. He ends up turning around and coming back toward Conway, still with the body in the back of the car. But he gets a flat. So he knows, well, he can't travel like that. So he pulls off the road, and he runs through a fence, and he leaves. He stops in a glade. It's not very far from where people are living, but he stops, and he burns the car with Mr. Newcomb inside. And then he goes and gets a ride on a bus back to Little Rock, but he takes Mr. Newcomb's bluish-gray coat, he puts that on, and goes back to Little Rock. So they get a little bit of evidence, physical evidence, and they did. They got evidence from every one of those crimes, and they debate about who should prosecute him, what jurisdiction should prosecute him.
Should we not talk about the crime scene? Because it's very fascinating. He has to corroborate this confession. And you describe his character too. He's not too bright, and he hasn't had much success in his life, but this is infamy. This is a fame, a celebrity that he's never experienced before. So the thing is that there's a media response because you've got Joe Wergis right there with the police and has access to everything. So what's the media response to the crime scene? And tell us about the crime scene looking for Fairine. And we didn't mention that Fairine is described. Tell us about the crime scene visit looking for Fairine and her remains.
Okay. That's the first thing they do after he confesses, and then they get him out. And it's kind of a rainy day, but he tells them that they did not go home that night from the Rainbow Garden Ballroom. After he dropped Katie Bryant off, he goes on out, drives out to this place by the river. There's a place called the Riverside Golf Course and the riverbank there. And nobody will ever know exactly what was said while he was taking her out there, but He did, and he shows detectives. He leads them out there, and it's a caravan of cars because by then he's page one news in Arkansas.
Right.
So, and out of state, there was a reporter, Dick Allen, from the Memphis Appeal, the Memphis Commercial Appeal. And so anyway, there's a caravan of cops and reporters following Red, who's in the front car. And most of the time when he goes around to these different crime scenes, he will be in the back seat, handcuffed to Peterson, and Wurgis will be right by his side too. So they go out there, and at first he has a kind of a problem locating her remains, but a woodcutter living close to the scene, Cecil Foster, he comes out there to see what's going on, and he tells them that he found a skull out there. So he kept it. He didn't tell anybody. He didn't call the cops or anything, but he kept it, and he goes back up to his house and brings that. Meanwhile, Red keeps looking around. Like they're poking around, and there's a picture of him. I love that picture. He's holding on to his stick. He's just been poking around. And then they do. When Foster comes back with the skull, he tells them where that was, and then he says, and there's a jawbone. And he starts looking around. He said, yeah, it's over here in this log. And they do. They find the jawbone. And when they get that out, Red says, yep, that's hers. See that buck tooth there? It always hurt me when we kissed. I mean, that's the way it was. That's the way he would talk. And also, they found the among her skeletal remains. And see, he told them that he thought animals, buzzards and all kinds of animals would eat up the body, that there wouldn't be anything left, and the water would carry the rest of it away. So he wasn't expecting to find anything. But they found quite a bit of her skeletal remains, including the skull, and they found that dress. Of course, it was in shreds by then. But they were able to identify that because of those unique closures.
Right.
So then all of a sudden it comes to him that their anniversary, their wedding anniversary, their first year wedding anniversary would have been coming up that month.
Yeah.
And I just, that he was like that with all the crime scenes. Like you say, he enjoyed being a celebrity. And when they retraced his route trying to find a place to leave Mr. Newcomb's body, they stop over at the a couple of places, but at the Cleburne County Courthouse. And this is one of those big old courthouses back then with the windows, that big windows that would, you know, you could push up. And he noticed a crowd that gathered, and there must have been 500 people there. All these little communities in that area had heard that the caravan was coming their way with Red Hall. So they gathered. When they found out he was in the courthouse, about 500 people showed up. And he was so pleased with it, he asked one of the detectives to raise the window so he could converse with the people in the crowd. And I'll tell you what it reminded me of. If you've ever seen that movie about Charlie Starkweather, he was a spree killer back in the, you remember him?
Right.
And
sure.
And the movie that they made about him called Badlands with Martin Sheen.
Mm-hmm.
Remember how he was just thrilled to death to get all this attention. And he says something along the lines of, you know, if I had some peanuts and popcorn, I bet I could make some money selling it to the crowd.
Sure.
He just, you know, it's like that. He's just, it's hard to understand.
Sure. You talked about the prosecuting attorney, Sam Robinson. Despite Hall confessing to more than a dozen murders in other states as well. You say that they decided in Pulaski County, well, Sam Robinson decided. What did he decide to do? How many would he prosecute and why?
He was going to, and I'll go into the reason for that later. He decided to prosecute just the murder of Faye because
right.
he said that was the strongest case. They had her in the courtroom. They had her remains, the clothing, and everything like that. And at one point when her father was testifying, Mr. Robinson had him come down in front of the jury and show them that he had the same buck tooth that his daughter had had. And they saw that jawbone with that buck tooth. But I'll tell you this, the reason, another thing, the sheriff in Faulkner County wanted to have the trial here, but they were afraid that there would be prejudice because Red was from here. And then, too, there had been something that happened many years before in which a man had been prosecuted in two different jurisdictions. And the first one that got him gave him life in prison. And then the second jurisdiction put him on trial, and they gave him death, which
right.
meant that he would have to serve life before they could execute him.
No,
that was a weird law. So anyway, they didn't want anything like that happening, and Mr. Robinson thought that the case against him for Faye's murder was the strongest.
Mm-hmm. Now, quickly, he gets a defense attorney named M.V. Moody, and
yep.
right away he's talking about laying a groundwork for insanity. And
yeah.
so they send him for an exam, a 30-day exam. Dr. Kolb, I believe, is the guy that first examined him. Tell us
mm-hmm.
about this examination, and then what happens with Red Hall, and his already previous confession.
Okay. Dr. Kolb, he did examine him, and it didn't take 30 days, but he would have the police bring him down in the morning and take him back to Little Rock at night because they had had a person escape from that old hospital and
sure.
Go out and murder somebody, I think, down in Texarkana. But Dr. Kolb, he asked Red about the murders and things like that, and he said, did you get any sexual gratification from that? And he'd say no. And how do you feel about this? How did you feel after you killed Faye? And he would say, relieved. So Dr. Kolb, he said that Red was sane. But M.V. Moody, his defense attorney, did plead him innocent by reason of insanity, and also he fought the confession. He said the confession was coerced, but that was ironed
right.
out, and nobody believed that. So, and then I've lost my train of thought. It was about Dr. Kolb.
Well, you talked about the confession that he gave
mm-hmm.
and what he said in that.
Yeah, well, the thing about the confession, and this was, I had never heard of this argument in court, but M.V. Moody tried to say that the confession he gave to Dr. Kolb couldn't be admitted because it was privileged information between a
right.
doctor and his client. I had never heard of that before. I had never heard that. I thought it was unique, but then when I started studying that, it was not unique. And that has been argued down through the years, whether or not when a person is sent to psychiatric hospital for observation, and then that psychiatrist testifies, is it as admissible? Because was it done when Red thought it was a doctor-client relationship? But, of course, in this case anyway, and I'm really not sure. I'm not educated well enough on the law about that, but that did not stand either. Mr. Moody tried his best. And Mr. Moody is another character that is just so, he's bigger than life, almost. Mm-hmm. He goes to extremes, and he goes to weird. I keep saying to people who buy the book, I say, now when you get to the part about the courtroom, about the trial, it really happened that way.
Yeah.
Moody is just unbelievable, the things that he will, he will go to all lengths to get his client off. He's very theatrical. He interrupts. I love this. the judge objected. I mean, usually it's the lawyer who objects. The judge objected. I thought that was funny. The judge was objecting to the repetitiveness. Oh, and like Robinson said at one point, he said, this may not be the trial of the century, but it may take a century because of Moody's distractions and things like that. But, yeah, it's just really interesting.
To bolster the confession, to bolster the confession from the psychiatrist, of course, this becomes a battle of the psychiatrist, and there's many psychiatrists that testify at this trial. But there are were instances with Oliphant and Judd and Sims and various law enforcement close to this case that he also confessed to. And so part of the trial is just, and the defense has a hard time with it, in that there are many reliable, credible witnesses that also he confessed to certain aspects of these murders, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah, he tried to say at the trial that Red says, they threatened me, they threatened my family, they said they'd have to enlarge the jail to hold all my family members, and then he said something about, and they dragged me around, and Robinson would argue with and saying, dragged you around. What do you mean by that? And he said, well, I was handcuffed to it. They had me handcuffed to one of them, and he was just pulling on me. And then he'd say, Robin would say, but you were dragged? And he said, well, not really dragged, but I had to, you know, I had to keep up to keep from being dragged. And it was just crazy. But, yes, they had to hear that the argument that it was a coerced confession, but nobody believed that. I mean, that was one of the points of the defense. The defense said in the first place that, okay, he's insane. Well, first, the confession is coerced. And then he's not guilty because he didn't do it, because Moody even says that you cannot prove that those remnants of a human being on that table there are the remains of Faye Clemens Hall.
Right.
And so he says that they have no body. And if you have no body, you can't prove it is murder. But he does things like that. Moody does things like that all the way through the trial. And then, of course, he says innocent by reason of insanity. And in his charges to the jury, the judge did give them the options, not guilty, saying that he didn't do it, not guilty by reason of insanity, guilty, but with, what did he say, not clemency, something like mercy.
Diminished capacity?
Mercy, yes. And but when the jury comes back, they do recommend the death penalty. And
and it didn't take long.
That's it. It did not take long. No, it was. Was it 40 minutes? Something like that.
50. Yeah. 50
it didn't take
minutes,
long at all. Yes, yeah. It was in the middle of the night. But spectators, there were so many spectators at that trial. Everybody wanted to attend, and they wouldn't go very far if there was time to break for eating somewhere. They'd stay close so they would get their seats again. And yes, the verdict was handed down late in the middle of the night. So.
Walsey, his first wife,
yes.
Walsey is brought in to testify. And you talk
yes.
about his demeanor and his composure and sometimes his indifference at this thing. But tell us, when Walsey Hall comes in, it's a little bit different. And who does she bring in a little bit later? And this is a time when there's a little more relaxed security in terms of who sits at the council table. So tell us about this very dramatic event with Walsey and who
okay.
she brought in for him to see.
Yes, when Walsey testifies, and I always seem to hear her voice. I just hear it in my head, a very soft voice. And she talks about how Red had sort of like two minds, a mind to do good and a mind to do bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so while she's testifying, and in fact, I think he started crying before she even got on the stand, but
yeah.
Red cried through most of her testimony. But then they have a break, they have a recess, and she brings in the baby. He's about 2 years old by then, day. And Red sings happy birthday to his and bounces him on his knee and all that. So he perks up, you know, it makes him happy. Happy to see that baby and happy that Walsey's there. But like I said, on the other hand, he became overwhelmed with emotion when she was testifying and he would sob. Yeah, he was just very touched by all that.
It's very interesting, too, the insanity defense that you write about is that, Moody tries his best and puts on defense psychiatrist to, you know, push ahead their
yeah.
theory of what really happened and why this happened.
Mm-hmm.
But he talk about a psychotic personality, but then also about being a psychopath. So it becomes...
Yes.
kind of ridiculous in the threat of the defense in terms of, you know, an actual insanity definition, what would be considered
right.
insanity, not knowing right from wrong, but then they throw everything in there and calling him a psychopathic personality.
Yes.
It was confusing
yes.
what they were trying to prove here in vain, ultimately.
I know, and I was hesitant to include some of that because... it's almost as if Moody is long-winded. He just keeps going back to that all the time, the psychopathic personality. And like you say, it's all these different psychiatrists. And every time Moody will say, and what is the definition of a psychopathic personality? And they go through that over and over until finally he just, and Judge Auten, kind of helps bring that to a close, I think, because of Moody and the way he repeats questions. And the psychiatrist, though, some of the psychiatrists had just had a few minutes, really, to examine
mm-hmm.
Red the night before their testimony. So they can't
right.
say. They and then they listen to Moody and they listen to Red's family members who say that there's back then they called them mental defects in his
mm-hmm.
mother's family, trying to make believe that it runs in the family, that insanity. And like you said, there's a difference between insanity and being a psychopath. And I was hesitant about that in a way to include that, but I just wanted to show how that trial went. The trial itself, just unbelievable. It's remarkable. It's not like, it's certainly not like anything you've seen on TV. Perry Mason, it is not.
Yeah.
The Good Wife, it is not.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and then finally, of course, the judge, when he does instruct the jury, and he mentions that, you know, you can't really, I don't know how to phrase that, but he leaves it, and like he said earlier, on the confession, he was going to leave that to the jury to decide, did they believe the confession or not?
Right.
And was he saying or not? And he was leaving that conclusion to the jury after they heard all these different ones. One psychiatrist claimed that Red told him he suffered from hallucinations, auditory hallucinations, in which he would talk to a dead cousin. Nobody
sure.
had ever heard about that before. That was the first time it was ever brought up.
Right.
I don't know if that was Red. Just Red was great. I'll tell you, he could lie better than anybody. He would lie, say something in one sentence, and this is a good example of this. It's the last time that he sees Faye's father.
Right.
And he'll say to his father, you know, that it was an accident. I didn't mean to do it. I didn't mean to do it. But then again, in the same visit, he would say, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. You know, you got to believe me. I loved Faye. I mean, he can lie twice or three times in the same paragraph.
You write about the public response and the media response, and many detective magazines and comic books contain writings about Hall and gave him lurid monikers like the Arkansas Butcher, the Kill Crazy Murderer of Little Rock, and the Dr. Jekyll of Arkansas. But it was you still, once he was convicted, it was still the Gazette's Joe Werges who was the, you write, it was the main conduit through which the public came
yes.
to know Red Hall. And
very
he had access
so.
To him. So he had access to him. So what kind of access did he have to him? And given this death sentence, and that's what he was given, and it survived the appeal process. So tell us about mm-hmm. the relationship, and how close does Joe Werges get to Red Hall in his last days?
Okay. Yes, in the beginning, he's just going along, and he does get exclusive interviews while Red is still in jail. But when it comes time for the when it comes time to go around to all the crime scenes, Joe is there. And then when he's driven down to the prison, Joe is there. And then I have explained earlier in the book that Joe not only is friends with the police and the sheriff, he's also friends with the assistant superintendent at the prison. They go out back there and fish a lot. And Joe will stay overnight there sometimes in one of the cells. And now the death house was at Tucker prison. And he would sometimes spend the night in a cell there, and he would be there for the execution. I mean, he was there. He said something about Red's last meal. Joe was going to be there, and Red was just tickled to death about that. He said he was so honored that Joe would do that, would share his last meal, and he did. And he just Red looked upon Joe, especially Joe, as a friend. But he also looked upon the detectives who had put him away, basically. He thought they were a swell bunch of fellas, and that's what he said, swell bunch of fellas. He didn't have any ill will toward anybody. He thought that he was religious because his dad was a preacher, so he was brought up that way, and he was just leaving it all to God, and he was at peace with himself. He was nervous, sometime, but then they said it was he stopped being nervous, and he was actually, I think one of the people said he had a jocular conversation while they were shaving his head the execution, yes. Yeah.
Now, lastly, after his execution, this story, when we talked about the World War II and Germany's surrender, this story would have been much bigger. This James Weyburn Red Hall would be much more infamous, especially given the confessions and the body count of this serial killer and his incredible character and demeanor through this whole thing. He's a very, very unusual killer with a peculiar character, to say the least. Tell us what prevented this story from being much bigger.
The war in Europe was coming to an end while all this was happening, when he was on that final spree. And I kind of theorized that once he killed Faye, he just lost all control. I think he may have loved her at some point, and the fact that he murdered somebody he may have loved and in such a brutal manner, I think it just sent him, pushed him over, completely over the edge, and he got careless, and he started killing on that spree. The war. Now, when all of this was happening, and the Hitchhike murders, and not really Faye, that didn't really make the papers, but the Hitchhike murders did, of course. But the papers were all about the war in Europe, and had been, throughout the war, with a list of people who had perished and the ones missing in action, and just all about the war, what was taking place in the Pacific, what was taking place in Germany. But the trial itself, when Red's trial was on, and it lasted only 3 days, I believe, the war in Europe ended. And, there was just jubilation and relief all across the country. And the people down in Little Rock, they were celebrating. They'd be out there in the streets celebrating while this very somber trial was going on. So the newspaper, if it had not been for Joe Wurgis, I don't know that Red Hall would ever have gotten any attention at all. I don't know. It's so hard to, would he have gotten careless and gotten caught anyway, or would he just gone on killing? I don't know. When he started confessing, lawmen from all across the country came to talk to him. And as you said, I mentioned some that almost definitely, the Lambert Nipper case, that was Dr. Lambert was an osteopath from, he was in Kansas, I believe. And he was traveling, and he picked up Corporal Nipper, who was going back to his base. So he had already picked up one hitchhiker, and then Red came along, and they picked him up, and Red killed both of them. And one thing that was very hard, now this is the hardest part of the research, there was so very little in newspapers. Murder was fairly commonplace. I hate to say it, and it still is, but being commonplace, some murders you never even hear about unless they're particularly gruesome or the body count is more. And so I tried my very best to make sure that nobody had ever solved these crimes that Red was strongly accused of committing. There was, yes, Corporal Nipper's cousin, who now lives in North Carolina or South Carolina, North Gaston, that's North Carolina, isn't it? Anyway, his cousin did confirm that the family said no, that had never been solved. So the Lambert Nipper case, I do really believe, and the authorities believed that Red did do that. And also James Owen in Seminole, Oklahoma. The sheriff there, Jake Sims, and he's quite a character too. And he had helped catch, I think it was like 50 murderers. But he never solved the case of James Owen. James Owen was killed around Christmas time and in 1940 or 40, I believe.
Yeah, 1940, yeah.
And, he was parked near a railroad track. And when Red couldn't hitchhike, he would hop a freight. So, Owen, he had his head bashed in. He wasn't shot, but his head was bashed in. And Jake Sims, the sheriff, or the police chief of Seminole, he had seen Red there many times. He said it was a common, you know, he had seen him before. And he said that he truly believed, he would always believe, that Jim Owen was killed by Red Hall.
Yes,
and there were
absolutely.
Others. I really couldn't track Wayman Peacock Jr. That was a toughie.
Mm-hmm.
I tried contacting his family, and I just couldn't get anybody. So that, like I said, we'll put an asterisk by his name because Red might have done it, but who knows?
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you so much, Janie Nesbitt Jones, for coming and talking about this remarkable, the Arkansas Hitchhike Killer, James Wayburn Red Hall. It's been remarkable speaking to you. Thank you so much for this. I know this is a History Press release. Maybe you could just tell us if there's an Amazon page that might find this work, this book available.
Yes. Yes, you can find it in several online bookstores, Amazon, of course, and in some of the brick-and-mortar stores like Barnes & Noble. Books a Million, hopefully not too far in the future. There was a sort of a slow rollout, partly because of the weather, the snow, you know, when everybody was and all that and problems. But, yes, and most online bookstores, you can find it, and some brick-and-mortar stores also. And I hope to have my website up and running in the not-too-distant future. It's just that, I still work for AY Magazine. I'm doing another murder mystery for them. So between that and life itself, I haven't gotten around to my own website yet. But thank you so much for having me on your show, the podcast. I've really enjoyed it, and I do hope that listeners found it entertaining and informative.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Janie Nesbitt Jones, the Arkansas Hitchhike Killer, James Wayburn Red Hall. Thank you so much, and have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.